That's four. And that means it is my great pleasure to welcome my regular guest, Chris Carey, who kindly volunteers his time each week to select and research our classic picks and then comes in to share his findings. And this week, this is a pretty easy one to call a classic and a no-brainer for me. We're a big fan of The Clash here at KXCI and on the home stretch. This week, we're taking a look at London Calling, came out right around this time 40 years ago. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course.
Yeah, so yeah, this is a big one. It came out 40 years ago this week. The Clash, of course, formed in London in 76, kind of out of the bones of various different London acts. So they were already kind of part of what was becoming a punk scene. Of course, it was Joe Strummer on guitar and vocals, and Mick Jones on guitar and vocals, and Paul Simeon on bass, and Nick Topper Heaton on drums. They became a major influence in punk, also in post-punk and new wave, as well as a slew of other bands afterwards. They started punk, and by their third album, this album, they were already moving away from punk, even though they still kind of had the punk aesthetic all the way through this album. They made their public debut opening for the Sex Pistols on July 4th, 1976. So I might not ever forget that date. That's kind of an easy date to remember. And they were signed only about 30 gigs. They had enough of a hype themselves, and there was enough of a hype with the whole punk movement and with record labels that they signed to CBS in 1977 for £100,000, which today, that's £616,000 or $809,000.
Yeah.
So this relatively
new...
It's
pretty big, actually.
Yeah, it's really big. And I think that they were kind of at the right place at the right time as far as the label was concerned. But the fact that they paid that much for them, they saw something in them that they thought they would cash in on, and they did on their debut album. The self-titled album came out in 77, and it was immediately a hit in the UK and ended up being a gold album in both the US and the UK. And then their second album, Give 'Em Enough Rope, came out in 78. That was also well received and ended up peaking at number two on the UK charts. So they had quite a bit of freedom with the label by the time they wanted to record their third album, which was London Calling. And they went into the studio in August of 79 and recorded and rehearsed through November of 79. It was in Wessex Studio, which is kind of a famous studio. The producer, Guy Stevens, he was kind of a big music industry figure, DJ, record producer, band manager from the mid-60s until the early 80s. He's kind of credited as infusing the U.S. R&B influence in a lot of... He's like he was the first guy who turned on the Rolling Stones to 60s soul. And so because of that, and on his DJ programs, he played a lot of R&B. So he was a big influence on the music scene in the U.K. He actually gave Procol Harum and Mott the Hoople their names. He helped come up.
Really?
Yeah. And so he also introduced The Who and to U.S. Soul. He kind of helped out with the whole wider shade of soul song.
Oh, this is super interesting. I actually didn't know
Yeah.
this,
and so Guy Stevens, he's a really interesting figure. He was his alcoholic and drug fueled hijinks got him almost as much press during the 70s as his influence in the music world did. And so when the Clash said that they wanted to use him, at first CBS was kind of skeptical because they're like, this guy is crazily
loose cannon.
Yeah, but they worked really well together. All the Clash stated in various interviews how well they got along. He wanted the studio to feel like a rock club, so it was all, he had it trashed with beer cans and upturned chairs and everything. And even though it had this feel, they had a really strong work ethic. They worked like 18 hours a day, 6 days in a row for months. And I think when the record came out, not only did the buying public, the critics think, that this was a great album, so did the CBS was happy with the product as well. So, and the sad thing is that he died just 2 years after London Calling came out. He died.
Oh, wow.
He died from an overdose with prescription drugs. And this was the only album that the Clash worked with him on. And interestingly, I didn't know this, but they never used the same producer for any album.
I did know that, yeah.
So, I mean, there's not too many bands that do that. While they were recording, there was a lot of themes. There was always these themes in the Clash's music, but the whole socio-political thing came in a lot more with this album than it had with the first couple of records. Also, I thought this was kind of interesting. This, I think, was the very first double LP that was a punk record. I don't know if there's probably not too many double LP punk records because most punk songs
by nature are abbreviated.
Yeah. Commercially, this was mostly thanks to how big of a success the first two records. This came off the press and immediately shot to the top of the charts in the UK. It also peaked at number 27 on the U.S. Billboard chart. So for a kind of a punk album, which in 77 was still kind of, punk was like a year or two behind in the U.S. what it was in the U.K. So this was probably one of the first really big selling punk albums in the U.S. Maybe this after, never mind the Bollocks, but this one sold pretty good in the U.S. London Calling yielded two of their biggest singles of all time, London Calling, the title track, and Trains in Vain. Critically, everybody loved it immediately on both sides of the pond. And one critic actually said this was the first record that the Clash released, which was on par with the hype they had been receiving. And so before, I think they were getting good reviews, but nobody saw them as kind of the giant, artist they became until this album. And, over the years, it just increased. And many critics consider this like to be one of the best releases of the whole era, or the high water mark of the whole punk movement. The cover art, which I think is something I want to talk about just briefly.
Oh, I figured you were going to.
Well,
it's a big deal.
I mean, it's definitely one of the most iconic covers in rock. And it's a picture of Paul Simeon smashing his bass, and he was at the Palladium in New York City, which used to be the Fillmore East, and then the 70s it closed down and reopened as the Palladium, and there's a lot of famous bands that played there. He apparently was frustrated when he found out that the show-going public couldn't stand on their chairs at the show, and so he smashed his bass, and his P bass, actually to this day, that P bass is now in the Rock and Roll Museum in Cleveland, which I thought was kind of cool. And the picture, the woman who took it, Penny Smith, didn't want that photo used at first because she thought it was out of focus.
Yeah, she didn't like the composition of it either. Yeah.
But I mean, it's as iconic as a rock photo gets.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely one of the top ones. But this is, like I said, this is a huge album. The band's legacy is huge. Usually the Sex Pistols are kind of seen as the first kind of punk album, punk band in the UK. But I think that the Clash is typically looked at as the quintessential punk band.
Can I tell you something about that just actually made me remember? So one of my more interesting interviews early on in my print journalism career, I interviewed Rob Halford of Judas Priest. Mm. And I was asking him about what it was like, because Judas Priest started coming up in the UK in the late 70s, around the same time that the punk movement was happening. And so I was curious how that felt to be like fronting this operatic metal band as this, punk is very different. And I said, how did that feel? How did you feel about, those disparate peers in your circles? And he was like, well, he said, honestly, I thought Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols was just kind of bratty and self-entitled, and that it was just sloppy for the sake of sloppy. But he said, Joe Strummer, I really respected. He was a good writer, and he had a good work ethic.
Yeah, yeah, and
which I thought was great coming from Rob Halford of Judas Priest.
Well, no, but that's a great segue into how much they influenced not just punk, not just post-punk, not even just indie music. They've influenced such a wide variety of. I mean, it's easily to say that maybe only after bands like the Stones, the Beatles, and maybe Bob Dylan, they're definitely probably one of the 10 most influential bands of all time. I mean, everybody's, almost everybody cites them as a major influence, even in hip hop. I mean,
Public Enemy.
Yeah, Chuck D said that, that this band really influenced them, not so much in style, but their socio-political commentary. And he knew that stuff that was oftentimes ignored by the press, if you record about it, record it, then it ends up in album reviews and whatnot. So they were a pretty big deal in many ways.
There's a reason we celebrate them on a special day each year on International Clash Day, for sure.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Anything else to add before we get into your first selection?
Well, nothing. I mean, we could talk for a long time on this, but I did want to say, so most of the tracks we're playing later this week are some of their bigger songs, but I wanted to play one of their more obscure songs in this album, The Card Cheat, which I personally love. It's one of my favorite songs on the album. And I'm convinced that that if you listen to this song, I'm convinced that Bruce Springsteen, when he was recording his mid-80s albums, Born in the USA and Tunnel of Love, I'm convinced he listened to this song a lot. And Bruce Springsteen is a self-professed Clash fan.
Yeah, I know he is.
So that would not surprise me. But if you hear this and think about like Tunnel of Love and Born in the USA and that mid-80s Springsteen, I think you can totally hear it. Also, I'm also convinced that Mick Jones, who was lead vocalist on this one, I think his vocals to me remind me a lot of Ian Hunter, and I think they had in turn been listening to a lot of Mata Hoople, and there's some Mata Hoople influence in this.
All right, well, we'll turn our eagle ears on
okay.
when we listen to
yeah,
this
you can
one.
You can tell me if I'm wrong.